Section 3. The case of such as are given up of God to sin, and of fallen man in general, proves moral necessity and inability to be consistent with blameworthiness. Dr. Wibby asserts freedom, not only from coaction, but necessity, to be essential to anything deserving the name of sin, and to an action being culpable. In these words, Discourse on 5 Points, edit. 3. Pages 348. If they be thus necessitated, then neither their sense of omission or commission could deserve that name, it being essential to the nature of sin, according to St. Austin's definition, that it be an action equilibrum est abstinere. Three things seem plainly necessary to make an action or omission culpable. 1. That it be in our power to perform or forbear it, for, as Origen, and all the fathers, say, no man is blameworthy for not doing what he could not do. And elsewhere the doctor insists, that, when any do evil of necessity, what they do is no vice, that they are guilty of no fault, 126 are worthy of no blame, dispraise, 127 or dishonor, 128 but are unblameable. 129. If these things are true, in Dr. Whitby's sense of necessity, they will prove all such to be blameless, who are given up of God to sin, in what they commit after they are thus given up, dash that there is such a thing as men being judicially given up to sin, is certain, if the scripture rightly informs us. Such a thing being often there spoken of as in Psalm 81:12. So I gave them up to their own heart's lust, and they walked in their own counsels. Acts 7:42. Then God turned, and gave them up to worship the host of heaven. Romans 1:24. Wherefore, God also gave them up to uncleanness, through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves. Romans 1:26. For this cause God gave them up to vile affections. Romans 1:28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind, to do those things that are not convenient. It is needless to stand particularly to inquire what God's giving men up to their own heart's lusts signifies. It is sufficient to observe that hereby is certainly meant God so ordering or disposing things, in some respect or other, either by doing or forbearing to do, as that the consequence should be men continuing in their sins. So much as men are given up to, so much is the consequence of their being given up, whether that be less or more. If God does not order things so, by action or permission, that sin will be the consequence, then the event proves that they are not given up to that consequence. If good be the consequence, instead of evil, then God's mercy is to be acknowledged in that good, which mercy must be contrary to God's judgment in giving up to evil. If the event must prove that they are given up to evil as the consequence, then the persons who are the subjects of this judgment must be the subjects of such an event, and so the event is necessary. If not only coaction, but all necessity, will prove men blameless, then Judas was blameless, after Christ had given him over, and had already declared a certain damnation, and that he should verily betray him. He was guilty of no sin in betraying his master, on the supposition, though his so doing is spoken of by Christ as the most aggravated sin, more heinous than the sin of Pilate in crucifying him. And the Jews in Egypt, in Jeremiah's time, were guilty of no sin, in their not worshipping the true God, after God had sworn by his great name, that his name should be no more named in the mouth of any man of Judah, in all the land of Egypt, Jeremiah 44:26. Dr. Whitby Disc. On 5 Points, pages 302, 303 denies that men, in this world, are ever so given up by God to sin, that their wills should be necessarily determined to evil. Though he owns that hereby it may become exceeding difficult for men to do good, having a strong bent and powerful inclination to what is evil. But if we should allow the case to be just as he represents, the judgment of giving up to sin will no better agree with his notions of that liberty, which is essential to praise or blame, than if we should suppose it to render the avoiding of sin impossible. For if an impossibility of avoiding sin wholly excuses a man, then for the same reason, its being difficult to avoid it, excuses him in part. And this just in proportion to the degree of difficulty. If the influence of moral impossibility or inability be the same, to excuse persons in not doing or not avoiding anything, as that of natural inability, which is supposed, then undoubtedly, in like manner, mortal difficulty has the same influence to excuse with natural difficulty. But all allow that natural impossibility wholly excuses, and also that natural difficulty excuses in part, and makes the act or omission less blamable in proportion to the difficulty. All natural difficulty, according to the plainest dictates of the light of nature, excuses in some degree, so that the neglect is not so blamable as if there had been no difficulty in the case, and so the greater the difficulty is, still the more excusable, in proportion to the increase of the difficulty. And as natural impossibility wholly excuses and excludes all blame, so the nearer the difficulty approaches to impossibility, still the nearer a person is to blamelessness in proportion to that approach. And if the case of moral impossibility or necessity be just the same with natural necessity or coaction, as to its influence to excuse a neglect, then also, for the same reason, the case of natural difficulty does not differ in influence to excuse a neglect from moral difficulty arising from a strong bias or bent to evil, such as Dr. Whitby owns in the case of those that are given up to their own heart's lusts. So that the fault of such persons must be lessened, in proportion to the difficulty and approach to impossibility. If 10 degrees of moral difficulty make the action quite impossible, and so wholly excuse, then if there be 9 degrees of difficulty, the person is in great part excused, and is 9 degrees in 10 less blameworthy than if there had been no difficulty at all, and he has but 1 degree of blameworthiness. The reason is plain, on Armenian principles. Namely, because as difficulty, by antecedent bent and bias on the will, is increased, liberty of indifference and self-determination in the will is diminished. So much hindrance, impediment is there, in the way of the will acting freely, by mere self-determination. And if 10 degrees of such hindrance take away all such liberty, then 9 degrees take away 9 parts in 10, and leave but 1 degree of liberty. And therefore there is but 1 degree of blameableness, cateris paribus, in the neglect. The man being no further blameable in what he does, or neglects, than he has liberty in that affair for blame or praise, say they arises wholly from a good use or abuse of liberty. From all which it follows, that a strong bent and bias one way, and difficulty of going the contrary, never causes a person to be at all more exposed to sin, or anything blameable, because, as the difficulty is increased, so much the less is required and expected. Though in one respect, exposedness to sin is increased, namely, by an increase of exposedness to the evil action or omission, yet it is diminished in another respect, to balance it. Namely, as the sinfulness or blamableness of the action or omission is diminished in the same proportion, so that, on the whole, the affair, as to exposedness to guilt or blame, is left just as it was. To illustrate this, let us suppose a scale of a balance to be intelligent, and a free agent, and endued with the self-moving power, by virtue of which it could act and produce effects to a certain degree, xgr to move itself up or down with a force equal to the weight of 10 pounds. And that it might therefore be required of it, in ordinary circumstances, to move itself down with that force, for which it has power and full liberty, and therefore would be blameworthy if it failed of it. But then let us suppose a weight of 10 pounds to be put in the opposite scale, which in force entirely counterbalances its self-moving power, and so renders it impossible for it to move down at all, and therefore wholly excuses it from any such motion. But if we suppose there to be only 9 pounds in the opposite scale, this renders its motion not impossible, but yet more difficult, so that it can now only move down with the force of 1 pound. But however, this is all that is required of it under these circumstances. It is wholly excused from 9 parts of its motion, and if the scale, under these circumstances, neglect to move, and remain at rest, all that it will be blamed for will be its neglect of that 1/10th part of its motion, for which it had as much liberty and advantage as in usual circumstances it has for the greater motion, which in such a case would be required. So that this new difficulty does not at all increase its exposedness to anything blameworthy. And thus the very supposition of difficulty in the way of a man's duty, or proclivity to sin, through a being given up to hardness of heart, or indeed by any other means whatsoever, is an inconsistence, according to Drive Whitby's notions of liberty, virtue and vice, blame and praise. The avoiding of sin and blame, and the doing of what is virtuous and praiseworthy, must be always equally easy. Dr. Whitby's notions of liberty, obligation, virtue, sin, etc., led him into another great inconsistence. He abundantly insists that necessity is inconsistent with the nature of sin or fault. He says, in the aforementioned treatise, pages 14, who can blame a person for doing what he could not help, and, pages 15, it being sensibly unjust to punish any man for doing that which was never in his power to avoid. And, pages 341 to confirm his opinion, he quotes one of the fathers, saying, why doth God command, if man hath not free will then power to obey? And again, in the same and the next page, who will not cry out, that it is folly to command him, that hath not liberty to do what is commanded? And that it is unjust to condemn him, that has it not in his power to do what is required? And, pages 373. He cites another saying, a law is given to him that can turn to both parts. 1e. Obey or transgress it. But no law can be against him who is bound by nature. And yet the same Dr. Whitby asserts that fallen man is not able to perform perfect obedience. In pages 165, he has these words, the nature of Adam had power to continue innocent and without sin. Whereas, it is certain our nature never had. But if we have not power to continue innocent and without sin, then sin is not inconsistent with necessity, and we may be sinful in that which we have not power to avoid. And those things cannot be true, which he asserts elsewhere, namely, that if we be necessitated, neither sins of omission nor commission would deserve that name, pages 348. If we have it not in our power to be innocent, then we have it not in our power to be blameless. And if so, we are under a necessity of being blameworthy. And how does this consist with what he so often asserts, that necessity is inconsistent with blame or praise? If we have it not in our power to perform perfect obedience to all the commands of God, then we are under a necessity of breaking some commands, in some degree, having no power to perform so much as is commanded. And if so, why does he cry out of the unreasonableness and folly of commanding beyond what men have power to do? Armenians in general are very inconsistent with themselves in what they say of the inability of fallen man in this respect. They strenuously maintain that it would be unjust in God to require anything of us beyond our present power and ability to perform, and also hold that we are now unable to perform perfect obedience, and that Christ died to satisfy for the imperfections of our obedience, and has made way, that our imperfect obedience might be accepted instead of perfect. Wherein they seem insensibly to run themselves into the grossest inconsistence. For as I have observed elsewhere, they hold that God, in mercy to mankind, has abolished that rigorous constitution or law that they were under originally, and instead of it, has introduced a more mild constitution, and put us under a new law, which requires no more than imperfect sincere obedience, in compliance with our poor and firm impotent circumstances since the fall. Now how can these things be made consistent? I would ask, of what law are these imperfections of our obedience a breach? If they are a breach of no law that we were ever under, then they are not sins. And if they be not sins, what need of Christ dying to satisfy for them? But if they are sins, and the breach of some law, what law is it? They cannot be a breach of their new law, for that requires no other than imperfect obedience, or obedience with imperfections, and therefore to have obedience attended with imperfections is no breach of it. For it is as much as it requires. And they cannot be a breach of their old law, for that, they say, is entirely abolished. And we never were under it. They say, it would not be just in God to require of us perfect obedience, because it would not be just to require more than we can perform, or to punish us for failing of it. And, therefore, by their own scheme, the imperfections of our obedience do not deserve to be punished. What need, therefore, of Christ dying to satisfy for them? What need of his suffering to satisfy for that which is no fault, and in its own nature deserves no suffering? What need of Christ dying to purchase that our imperfect obedience should be accepted, when, according to their scheme, It would be unjust in itself that any other obedience than imperfect should be required. What need of Christ dying to make way for God's accepting of such obedience, as it would be unjust in him not to accept? Is there any need of Christ dying to prevail with God not to do unrighteously? If it be said that Christ died to satisfy that old law for us, that so we might not be under it, but that there might be room for our being under a more mild law. Still I would inquire, what need of Christ dying, that we might not be under a law, which by their principles it would be in itself unjust that we should be under, whether Christ had died or no, because, in our present state, we are not able to keep it. So the Armenians are inconsistent with themselves, not only in what they say of the need of Christ's satisfaction to atone for those imperfections, which we cannot avoid, but also in what they say of the grace of God, granted to enable men to perform the sincere obedience of the new law. I grant indeed, says Drive Stebbing, 130, that by original sin, we are utterly disabled for the performance of the condition, without new grace from God. But I say then, that he gives such a grace to all of us, by which the performance of the condition is truly possible. And upon this ground he may and doth most righteously require it. If Dr. Stebbing intends to speak properly, by grace he must mean that assistance which is of grace, or of free favor and kindness. But yet in the same place he speaks of it as very unreasonable, unjust, and cruel, for God to require that, as the condition of pardon, that is become impossible by original sin. If it be so, what grace is there in giving assistance and ability to perform the condition of pardon? Or why is that called by the name of grace, that is an absolute debt, which God is bound to bestow, and which it would be unjust and cruel in him to withhold, seeing he requires that, as the condition of pardon, which he cannot perform without it?